We'll work this rain report for November 7, 2014 in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Northwest Arkansas studio of the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with this rain report that features a ham who grew up in San Diego, some 35 miles south of where Rain's founder did. A small ham radio that has taken the market by storm is the Elecraft KX3. The man and mind behind Elecraft is Wayne Burdick, N6KR. Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, spent an hour with Wayne via Skype for Eric's QSO Today podcast. We'll be excerpting from that lengthy interview over the next 2 weeks. Here's our first excerpt.
I was ripping apart radios at a very early age, probably from maybe age 6. We had a nice clean garage until I discovered that I could clip the little parts out of ancient radios and TVs, and I started collecting them in bins. I didn't quite know what to do with them yet, but that was really the beginning of the whole thing. Along the way, I did some dubious experiments. For example, I once plugged a very large permanent magnet speaker directly into the 120-volt wall outlet to see what that would sound like. And believe me, you don't want to do it. You get a very, very loud 60 hertz buzz for about 5 seconds, and then the speaker blows up. You know, I tried to make a TV from sheets of glass, things that you can expect a six-year-old to do. But then when I was 8, my dad bought me the first of a series of Radio Shack Science Fair project kits. The very first one I got was one of those little red plastic perf boxes with a clear plastic cover. It was an 8-note electronic organ. I think my dad probably figured out that I was going to be an engineer because I stayed up till something like 11 o'clock soldering that thing together. When I first turned it on, hooked up the 9-volt battery, it sounded like an organ, but the notes were out of tune. I spent a whole bunch more time figuring out that if I could just change the resistor values a little bit, I could actually get it in tune. I was blessed or cursed, as you might imagine, with a good musical ear. So I knew they were out of tune, and that's how I learned about paralleling and series combinations of resistors in order to change their values. When I was a little older, maybe age 10, I was up the street at a friend's house, noticed that there was a huge antenna next to his house. It was his dad's antenna, and he took me inside the house. This was the Smiths. And Mr. Smith had a huge room that was filled with gear. I believe it was Collins gear. I didn't understand anything about radio gear at the time, but there was some very impressive things like a very large floor-standing amplifier and an ASR-28 teletype terminal. This guy was a real pro. His walls were covered with QSL cards. That's when I first got interested in radio. I had no idea what he exactly was up to, but then his dad came in and made a contact with somebody in Australia, and I was pretty much hooked.
So when did you get to the point where you took your first test?
Junior high. Infamously, I actually failed the novice exam the first time I took it because Roger Miller and Dick Leffler taught the science class. They were the ones who ran the club at Parkway Junior High. They pretty much put the emphasis on learning code, and somehow we were supposed to learn the regulations and technical details through osmosis, I suppose, maybe just as members of a science class. We all took the test, and very few of us actually passed because we hadn't studied the license manual. But then we cracked the books out, and we actually did pass the test. Parkway Junior High had a very nice radio club and a radio room. It was there that I made my first QSO using one of those 80 to 100 pound receivers. I believe it was an NCX300, the kind with the big rotating dial, the slide rule, a knob that you crank to change bands, and then you get a different slide rule in each band. I mean, it was a beautiful piece of mechanical work. The very first QSO I had, I was pretty good on CW, but there was one character that I hadn't learned yet, which was da-da-da-da-dit, which happens to be a forward slash to use the current parlance. The operator I was talking to on 15 meters was a novice, a WB3 something, and he was signing slash KX6, but I didn't know what the slash meant. So when he told me he was in Hawaii, I was thinking, what? This guy's a three call. You know, he should be in Pennsylvania somewhere. That was my auspicious introduction to QSOs.
But I think by the time I met you, you were already an advanced class licensee in high school.
I realized right away that I wanted more spectrum. I was not happy with just being stuck in the novice bands, and the club was pretty aggressive, having everybody upgrade their licenses as soon as possible. I was also doing Morse code and Boy Scouts, and I was quickly up to 20 words per minute. So I actually went right through the general and then the advanced, and then I think I had the extra by the time I was 16. I had the honor of taking my extra class exam in Mission Valley at the Town and Country Hotel. There was actually a TV crew there that day, so I had actually some TV exposure from the wrist to my fingertips because they needed somebody to send Morse code on the news segment.
What's your favorite operating mode, and how did that come about?
I really like CW. I'm not sure why. Maybe it harkens back to my Boy Scouts days where we had a contest called a jamboree, where you take all of the Boy Scout troops and outdoors and you hike around and do various events. And the only event that our troop got a blue ribbon in was CW. And I think it's because I was the one who was able to copy it at reasonably high speed across a valley, by the way, using signal lights. That was one of my early experiences with CW. But also, you know, CW has a very high signal noise ratio, both in the literal sense, signal noise as measured using equipment, but also CW has a very high signal noise ratio semantically. It uses compact abbreviations that are known worldwide. It transcends language barriers, and it transcends fading and interference. You can narrow the bandwidth down and have a lot of contacts being made in a very narrow bandwidth. It might have been PSK-31 if I had gotten started in ham radio 30 or 40 years later, but CW was the narrowband digital mode of choice when we were kids. And another thing I really like about CW is that the equipment can be very simple, straightforward. It can be as complicated as you want. You know, Elecraft K3 or KX3 is a good example of a radio that throws a lot of hardware at the CW operating problem, how to, you know, optimize for filtering, etc. But you can also use really simple equipment. One of the very first things I ever built, which really got me interested in homebrew and in QRP, was a crystal oscillator. I didn't even use a circuit board. As I mentioned earlier, I had bins full of parts laying around, TVs and radios I'd ripped apart. And all of that stuff migrated with me as we moved from Fletcher Hills to La Mesa when I was about 11. I dug around in that box. I found a transistor. In fact, I think I bought a transistor, probably a CK722 or some ancient thing from, I think I bought one from Heathkit, believe it or not. I claimed it was a spare part, so they sent me one right away. So I took my CK722 and, or maybe it was a 2-in-22, which is the cockroach of transistors. I then twisted the leads and made an oscillator circuit and basically had this grizzled wad of parts laying there on the workbench with everything all tied together. And I hooked up a 9-volt battery through a code key, which is definitely not a good idea if you're trying to avoid key clicks. Nonetheless, it worked. I hooked the output of that oscillator up to, I think it was the guy wire on the existing TV antenna on the roof. And I worked a guy 200 miles away. I'm guessing I was probably running 100 to 200 milliwatts at the time with an untuned antenna on 40 meters. That kind of thing, you know, when you're 15 or 14, can really get you hooked on using CW and using low power. I later went on and turned my HT37 100-watt transmitter down to something like 200 milliwatts and was working all over the country. It was a real blast.
Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about the Radio Shack that you had there in Mesa? I think that for a teenager to have the kind of facility that you had, seemed to me it was unusual. Maybe it wasn't.
Well, my mom remarried about the time I got my first license. And my stepfather was a really wise guy. And he recognized that my interest in radio was the kind of thing that could be so distracting that it would probably keep me off the streets, you know, and keep me from doing all the usual crazy stuff that the teenage boys did in the early 1970s. He turned out to be right. I was so preoccupied with building things in the Radio Shack, I managed to spend a good chunk of my time doing that. It was a little bit of guitar and a little bit of girls and a little bit of snorkeling and camping trips. But for the most part, I was very interested in heading out to my little private enclave and designing things, experimenting, etc. He wanted to make it even easier for me to escape the real world and do my thing. And so he offered to build an outdoor shed just for the shack. So I had a 10 by 10 foot metal building that we probably bought at Sears, and we put it together, built workbenches, and it was Teen Ham's dream come true.
You're listening to a conversation with Wayne Burdick, N6KR, co-founder and CTO of Elecraft, an American grassroots amateur radio manufacturer whose KX3 has scored high marks among both QRPers and contesters alike. We'll continue this first of two excerpts from Eric Guth, 4Z1UG's Skype interview with Wayne, in a moment. This is the Rain Report, heard in Northwest Arkansas Thursday nights after the 7 p.m. Benton County Radio Operators Net on the 145.290 MHz repeater and a PL of 110.9 Hz.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
What effect did amateur radio have on your post-high school life?
I would say not a whole lot early on. I joined the Coast Guard, got a lot of electronic technician training through the Coast Guard, and went to the engineering center in Wildwood, New Jersey, which was mostly preoccupied with Loran C and Omega navigation aids. And that was a great time. I was 19 at the time. I was so preoccupied with that, there wasn't a whole lot of time for radio. I did spend a year in Bermuda. And while I was there, that's when I applied for a two-letter call. And they had just changed the rule. So you didn't have to be a ham for 20 years in order to get a two-letter call. You just needed to have an extra class license. So I applied for several different call signs, and I got N6KR, which I thought would be a great CW call, which it is. I did meet several hams who lived in Bermuda. They all lived in exotic sounding places at the end of long winding roads. One guy lived in a house that didn't have an address. It was just called Silver End. And so I spent quite a bit of time hanging out with guys who lived in Bermuda, British accents. It was all very exotic and surreal for me. And I had a little shack set up at the Coast Guard base. But again, throughout that entire period, I was more or less preoccupied with the Coast Guard and just sort of coming of age issues and work. Later on, though, I became very busy with college and met my future wife and didn't really do a whole lot with amateur radio until I think it was 1982. I guess I was 25 or so at the time. And that's when I wrote my very first article. I had a Heathkit HW8 that normally covers 80, 40, 20, and 15 meters. And I modified the 80-meter band for 30 meters instead, which at the time was a new band, and wrote a little article that showed up in QST. And I kind of got hooked on being a technical author at that time.
You have an unusual college background. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I started off more or less with the usual junior college path, where this is very typical of Californians. You can take a lot of liberal arts courses and the usual math and physics and chemistry, et cetera. And then you can use that to transfer to a four-year college. That actually reduces the cost of a four-year college education by a huge amount. And since I was kind of a vagabond at the time, when I got out of the Coast Guard, I was on a GI Bill and I moved around quite a bit. And I actually spent a good portion of my first 2 years in college at Grossman College in San Diego, and also at Santa Barbara City College, Santa Barbara, more or less having a good time, taking classes part-time, et cetera. And then by the time I got back to San Diego and was ready to transfer to University of California, San Diego, which is in La Jolla, I really was interested in a lot more things than just electronics. The thing that caught my fancy was a degree program called Cognitive Science, which at the time I was there was administered through the psychology department. Now there's a much larger cognitive science department, as you can imagine, with the emphasis these days on artificial intelligence and natural language processing, things like Siri. This whole field has exploded since I was at UCSD. But those are the early days of parallel distributed processing and neural networks and cognitive engineering, genetic algorithms. And so I had a really interesting couple of years at UCSD and graduated with a degree in cognitive science. It did have a computer science core curriculum, and a lot of what I have done since then is firmware engineering and user interface design. So those are aspects of design that are very pertinent to amateur radio, but I have to say that the RF engineering portion of my activities was pretty much self-taught or just school of hard knocks. I think maybe the truth is I'm actually a sort of frustrated mechanical engineer. Uh-huh. In fact, I do a lot of the mechanical engineering for Elecraft. We have an outstanding, well-trained mechanical engineer. But before he came along, I was pretty much doing all of the sheet metal design. My mechanical engineering, a sort of OJT, on-the-job training, has arisen because of the mother of necessity rule, and also because we have a tendency at Elecraft to try and make things as small as possible. And as a result, you design yourself into some very interesting corners, and you end up with some very interesting solutions when, in the future, customers who own a particular product say, hey, can we do this? And we look at it and we say, well, we didn't think of that from the beginning, but maybe we could do that. And then we find a way to shoehorn something in. A good example of that is the K2's DSP board. We have an option for the K2 called the KDSP2. There was never any plan originally to put DSP into the K2, but a gentleman by the name of Lyle Johnson, who I work with every day, one of our engineering staff members, he decided he would reverse engineer the analog audio filter option that we have for the K2 and then figure out how to insert the DSP board in at that point. And it turned out that we had enough hooks and enough space in there so that he was able to build his own DSP module. And then he contacted us and said, hey, you want DSP in the K2? And he said, I'm thinking about selling these. And so we loved it. So we hired him and took the KDSP2 on as a project. That's just one of many examples of how our customers help us figure out what we're going to put into the radios next. And so far, we've been lucky and we've left just enough room to get things inside that people wanted. Another good example is the 2-meter module in the KX3. It's the size of a credit card, and we really weren't sure if we were going to be able to do it. We left just barely enough room in there to screw the tab down on the TO220 power amplifier device. And we left just enough room in there for our VHF, UHF engineer to create this little transverter module. This is a part of our overall effort to use every last centimeter of volume inside the radios.
This concludes our first of two excerpts from Eric Guth, 4Z1UG's Skype conversation with Wayne Burdick, N6KR, co-founder and CTO of Elecraft, a unique American radio manufacturer that draws upon the marketplace to create new radio designs and improve existing Elecraft radios, like the very popular KX3. Next time, Wayne will talk about how Elecraft evolved. This interview is available in its entirety as Program 11 on the QSO Today podcast, available at qsotoday.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2014 Rain, all rights reserved. Now, for all those connected with the Rain Report, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73. This is the Rain Report. Available on Twitter at #TheRainReport and on the web at www.therainreport.com.